When the miles rack up faster than your flush count, that's when you'll truly appreciate your hunting vest from Final Rise. Built for the uplands and proudly sewn in the USA, the complete lineup of hunting vests from Final Rise, from their all-new Summit XT down to the minimalist Sidekick system, are all built upon the foundational load-bearing waist belt and low-profile shoulder strap system, which allow you to carry all the gear you need and do so comfortably while maintaining your ability to move freely and perform when you need to most. With a complete lineup of accessories and newly released performance field apparel, Final Rise has the gear you need to help you get the most out of every mile and every flush. Final Rise gear is built for the uplands. Get yours today at finalrise.com. This episode of the Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. On this episode of the show, we recognize the 10th anniversary of the American Woodcock Society. Thanks for tuning in to episode number 263. Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Thanks for joining us today. We're going to chat with our guests from the Ruffed Grouse Society and American Woodcock Society, Gabe Stone and Kevin Sterling, in just a minute. First, I do want to quickly thank Patreon patrons of the Birdshot Podcast, those of you out there making voluntary contributions in support of the show to keep these conversations coming your way. Patrons are eligible for bonus content, Patreon giveaways, and we send everybody some Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers. We're doing a Patreon giveaway this month for an Onyx Elite subscription. Everyone signed up by the end of the month will be eligible. You can learn more and sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. All right, don't forget to leave a rating, leave a review, subscribe to the podcast, follow the podcast, whatever options you have in your podcast player, share an episode of the podcast, or tell a friend about an episode you heard on the Birdshot Podcast. All of those little things are appreciated, and they do go a long way in supporting the show and future episodes on the way. All right, one final reminder for a very limited time sale going on at finalrise.com. You all have likely heard me talk about my hunting vests and gear from Final Rise. Made in USA hunting gear, made by bird hunters for bird hunters, and right now, for just a couple more days, March 17th is the last day you can take advantage of the once annual sale over at finalrise.com. You can use the promo code FR24 to save 10% site-wide at finalrise.com. Grab yourself a new Upland bird hunting vest or try out one of their turkey vests. They've got brush pants, top layers, accessories, hats, tees, all kinds of great stuff over at finalrise.com. Once again, just a couple more days to take advantage of their once annual sale. Use that promo code FR24 to save 10% at finalrise.com through March 17th. All right, on with the show. Today we're talking to Gabe Stone and Kevin Sterling of the Ruffed Grouse Society and American Woodcock Society, which is the main theme of our show today. Caught up with these guys at Pheasant Fest recently and the Seaweed Show down in South Carolina. They are currently celebrating the 10th anniversary of the American Woodcock Society that kicked off as the sister organization to the Ruffed Grouse Society back in 2014. It is feeling like spring across much of the country, and for many of us, that means the return of our beloved American Woodcock to the woods and covers nearby. I have yet to see one personally as of March 14th here in Duluth, Minnesota, although I was texting back and forth with a buddy that lives on the edge of the swamp and regularly has woodcock in his backyard sky dancing and painting pretty much year round except the winter. And he just told me that last night he officially heard woodcock in the swamp overhead at dusk last night. So still secondhand report at this point, but they may be as far north as me by the time you're listening to this. And in fact, since I'm done recording this intro, I am going to head out into the woods. It's a beautiful sunny day, 43 degrees. I'm going to cut the dogs loose and go see for ourselves. Maybe we'll find some grouse. That's the goal. And perhaps if, in fact, the woodcock have returned, we might find a couple of those too. But with that in mind, we are going to, again, welcome onto the show Kevin and Gabe from AWS, They will share some information about an ongoing membership drive and some promos you can take advantage of to sign up for the American Woodcock Society. They've got hats from Duck Camp Company. They've got a new t-shirt from Pike Gear with some original artwork by our good friend Jay Dowd. Upland Lowlife, it's on the cover of the RJS AWS magazine this month, and some other benefits depending on which membership level you sign up for. So that membership drive actually ends this week. However, the team over at AWS did make the Birdshot Podcast a special landing page, and we've got a code for you, Birdshot24, that you can use through the end of the month if you would like to sign up for AWS and support the continued forest conservation and management efforts fueled by the RJS and AWS mission. You'll learn a little bit more about some of those things today. And of course, you can always visit ruffedgrousesociety.org to learn more. Keep that in mind. Check the link in the show notes for that landing page link and the membership drive promos for AWS. With that said, let's welcome into the conversation and on to the Birdshot Podcast of the American Woodcock Society, Gabe Stone and Kevin Sterling. Okay, we're going to lead off. What's the woodcock report in your areas? Gabe, you start us off. Anything?
Woodcock are back and well. I was in Wisconsin and the Upper Peninsula for the last 2 years. I'm now back home in Southeast Michigan. I have buddies and members, et cetera, that especially this last weekend, they're starting to really see an influx of woodcock coming back in here, as well as some members down in Ohio. I haven't heard anything explicitly yet from Indiana, Illinois, but I am kind of in the base of the thumb in the Lower Peninsula of Michigan, and reports are coming back pretty strong. Unfortunately, my dogs are actually in the UP right now, so I don't get to play in on any of the fun. I can't quite sniff them out myself yet. I haven't found any. But,
well, Gabe, you got work to be doing.
Exactly. We're busy. It's that time of year.
Kevin, what about you? Where are you at, man? We're gonna learn a little bit about you, but where are you at?
Yeah, sure. I'm in the Hudson Valley of New York, about an hour and a half north of the city and below the Catskills. So I found one in the snow in mid-February, which was unexpected. And so far, haven't gotten like big flights in yet. I've seen a few people finding them in the Catskills. I feel like typically we don't get them pretty well until like this coming week, I think. Like, so this, what's today, the 12th? So I would suspect the end of this week and into next is kind of when I've gotten like big flights historically. So far, just one here or there.
Cool. Well, I want to dive in.
You
right there.
Get,
no, I haven't. Thank you for reminding me that. I've been doing a lot of traveling lately, and I've seen you guys at multiple events. So we've all been kind of on their own. I haven't been out in the woods specifically, like running the dogs, looking for birds or anything, even though with this crazy, weird winter, it's like the perfect winter to get, you know, some bonus training in with the dogs on wild birds. I mean, there's literally no snow in the woods here, which it's almost hard to believe. I think we might get some later this week, but I've just been doing our regular exercise runs, and that's where we don't really get into a lot of birds, which I'm okay with because it's we're going there on a daily basis to get exercise, and I don't want to be messing with birds all the time. So, but my Hartley did, he went on point the other day, and I walked in and flushed a nice big male grouse. And I put a little thing up on Instagram, and my friend Bailey Peterson, you guys probably know, she was like, I was hoping it wasn't a woodcock. I'm like, yeah, I have not seen any up here yet. And it's still, you know, I know they're in southern Minnesota, and they're probably not all that far away. They kind of tend to follow the snow, and obviously the conditions and thawed ground would be helpful. But yeah, I wouldn't be disappointed if they hung out further south for, I don't know, another week or two, get us through the middle of March. And it's, you know, the sun angle is up now, and we're definitely beyond the depths of winter, but you'd hate for a real nasty storm to come through after they're covered up around here. I guess that's how I think about it.
Got it.
Start with a, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, we actually, at Pheasant Fest, we got asked a lot from Minnesota folks about how we thought the mild winter was going to affect the birds. So I saw a common question. And just the consensus was, as long as there's not a, a hard freeze coming in or a freezing rain or anything like that, it's not such a bad thing.
Yeah. What was the folks were asking about both woodcock and grouse, which is, and I've been talking about the grouse stuff just again with the really weird winter, and you know, the glass half full optimist in me is like, well, we didn't really have the snow cover that you would traditionally think of for great ruffed grouse survival, but the temperatures were so above normal that, you know, if nothing else, at least maybe they weren't super stressed with a lot of sub-zero. The sub-zero stuff we had was pretty short-lived. We had one solid week of it, but at that time, we coincidentally had like probably our most snow of the year. It was like 8 inches of fluff, and that was early January, and we came out of that, and then we didn't have a nighttime low under 20 degrees for like a month, which in January here is just, I mean, you literally can't make it up. So I don't know, it doesn't seem to have been the worst winter for grouse, but certainly some concerns if, you know, they don't have that snow roosting. So my question was there any sort of commentary or what have you been hearing on in that regard?
So some of the Minnesota folks were just saying, certainly they're probably going to get picked off by predators more if they're not able to snow roost. Food would be more abundant for the most part, I would think, just because they can get around and get it. And I think it was mainly just they were attributing the ice and the freezing rain as being like the main risks at this point, is just making sure that doesn't happen. And I don't want to jinx you guys in Minnesota. I know you got a good thing going on up there after last year. So, it's probably good if the winter was going to affect them. You're coming off of like a big population boom. So, it's kind of crystal ball at that point, I think, to see how it pans out. But, you know, just hope that the spring weather and the breeding season's good.
Gabe, any thoughts on it?
I would, you know, again, I by no means am I a biologist, but I would follow pretty much with what Kevin said, and again, emphasis on, from everything I hear, is ice without the snow, ice, freezing rain, you know, bunch of actual rain itself, even though it's still pretty cold out. That's what we want to look out for. And so far we've been pretty good.
Yeah, it is. There's so many variables, and it's fun to talk about and consider and make observations, but at the end of the day, you know, we will get I feel like the drumming counts, they do give you or they can provide a look at winter survival. What they don't tell you is nest success and brooding. And that obviously plays a huge role in what we see in the fall. So, you know, last year we were coming off a couple good winters and then had what appears to have been perfect nesting and brooding conditions, really. And so, yeah, there were a lot of birds in the woods at the end of the season, and we'll get a little bit of a data point as far as what made it through potentially with drumming counts, and we'll keep our fingers crossed for more good nesting and brooding conditions. Yeah. Gabe's got his fingers crossed in case this is audio only.
Yeah.
All right, Kevin, I want to get to know you a little bit. Mm-hmm. I feel like I know Gabe a little bit more. I heard him on Nick Adair's podcast, but Kevin, tell me your role at Rough Grouse Society, American Woodcock Society, and then kind of your little bit of your background in bird dogs and hunting and how you wound up working for the organization.
Yeah, for sure. So I work on the marketing team, and that's kind of a general answer because I've got a lot of hands in different cookie jars with social media and email marketing and website development, and even a lot of like product mix for both the store merchandise and also for like membership drives. So it's fun. And then I get to work on a lot of different things. I kind of got into the bird dog world through NABDA. So I've got two local chapters here, and my dog is a Vizsla. He's 6 years old right now. And somewhere along the way, my NABDA buddy said, well, if you're going to hunt grouse, you have to join the Rough Grouse Society. And so I said, all right, that sounds great. And kind of got into grouse hunting, and seems to be pretty common in my area. It takes people a couple of years to get their first bird, unless they're really lucky. I took a guy out this fall and he shot a big red male drummer like on the first trip, like almost like wide open shot. And I just said, hey, just want to let you know, this doesn't usually play out like that. Yeah. So
bar is set pretty high.
But Yeah, no, I mean, exactly. So, but then he was hooked. So I had met that guy actually duck hunting. And so he's like, yeah, grouse hunting's awesome. Please call me every time you go. So, but yeah, I mean, my background was kind of graphic design and marketing and whatnot. And, through the people in NAVDA, there was an opportunity at RGS and, you know, I kind of, applied to help them with a few things. And now I think this is like my fourth year working with them. In increasing capacities every year, they sort of find new things for me to work on. So, it's fun and exciting and a lot of growth is happening. So I feel like every year we like fix things that we've wanted to fix and get to work on things that, you know, were kind of like passion projects and, you know, keep watching membership, grow. So it's all good stuff. It's a fun time to be there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome to hear how you found your way into it. How did hunting start for you? Was that going way back to when you were younger? Was it a family thing? How did you get into bird hunting and dogs and the like?
Yeah. I kind of joke. I call it like the tragedy of my life. I grew up on the Eastern Shore of Maryland and I feel like my grandfather and uncles, everybody hunted. And, so when I was 9 years old, I like took to class, took to test and got my hunting license. And then they all just kind of quit hunting. So it just kind of like went on the shelf and, you know, I got into Boy Scouts and was like happy doing outdoor stuff with Boy Scouts. And, I used to live in New York City and, 9 years ago moved up to the Hudson Valley. And I think my second year living here, took to hunting class and started with spring turkey and was like really became, you know, as turkey hunting can do, turned me into a degenerate junkie pretty quickly. And, my local forest, I actually live next to like the most trafficked forest in New York State is like 10 minutes from my house. So, but they stocked it with pheasants. And so in my mind, I thought that stocked pheasants was like as good as it gets, being 10 minutes from my house. And, you know, sort of once I got into grouse and woodcock cutting, I realized that there were other things to be doing, but, through NAVDA, I've got the dog, you know, trained for duck hunting and stuff. So I do a lot of local duck hunting and hunt deer and hunt turkey and, you know, basically get into whatever I can with the dog. We did a lot of squirrel hunting this winter, which was fun too, like something to do locally.
Yeah.
Gabe, so he recently started spot burning my whole state when he said that we're lucky in New York. Our grouse season goes until February 28th or 29th, depending on, you know, if it's a leap year or not. So, I mean, I don't want you to drive from the Great Lakes to our paltry, sometimes paltry populations of birds. But I mean, certainly you get nice days in February where we're like hunting grouse in the sunshine in February. So it can happen.
Yeah, I thought about the conditions a lot this year. And I remember talking to Trip Way, another colleague of your guys. And you know, that was kind of eye-opening to me when he would talk about, you know, you get the October, November, sort of the prime grouse hunting. And then you sort of winter comes along, but then you like, sometimes you rise out of that. And on the tail end of like the deep, dark winter, you got more grouse hunting out there out east, which is definitely not the usual rhythm that we experience here.
Sorry for spot burning your whole state, Kevin.
Oh, you're good.
New York.
All good. They can, everyone should try it at least once. I've come to appreciate, you know, when we were at Pheasant Fest and the Minnesota and Wisconsin guys were kind of talking about Northwoods, we get that terrain north of the Adirondacks, like in timber country, but, my closest covers are more like your New England type. Like, I don't know if you've had, Joe Hussinger is a local guide, bird dog guy as well. He kind of said the classic New England is like where the rock wall meets the orchard meets the creek. And so it's funny, it's like that exact scenario is like where I shot my first grouse. It was like coming out of that. So orchards are fun and rock walls are fun and, you know, all that stuff. So we get a lot of that, especially in the Catskills. They don't do a lot of logging in a lot of that land. So you're really hunting more in like brushes and bushes than you are trees. So it's pretty great.
The thing I always hear about New York or often hear about New York is pocket covers. And, you know, New York's a big state and there is a lot of public land. Do you find yourself hunting mostly public land? Does it behoove you to look for private land access? How does that shake out?
Yeah. So New York City has multiple reservoirs all over the Catskills. And, you know, like what often happens in water systems is they flooded a bunch of towns pretty much and just kind of like created reservoirs in these valleys. And any body of water that touches, that eventually drains into those reservoirs, they bought access points to it, but then opened it up to the public. So if you use Onyx, you'll see all over the Catskills, there are all these little 7 acre, 15 acre, 40 acre, 60 acre, not big. Like I think the vast majority of them are under 100 acres, but they're owned by New York City, and you can get a free recreation permit for those lands. And so a lot of times if we hunt the Catskills, you mark 5 or 6 or 7 of those and just kind of see what you find and little or like hopscotch your way through all of that. But I've never felt short on public land in New York. I just feel like it's everywhere. So, you know, that DEP is what it's called, the Department of New York City, but that's kind of like a hidden gem that I think not just grouse hunters, but any kind of hunter should look at in New York State.
It's good to know, and good to know that you've got public land access. So you have turkeys on the brain right now?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's, again, being like the most trafficked forest, I feel like every time I'm in there, I'm turkey hunting, I either bump into another hunter or try and avoid a hunter and piss off another hunter. I mean, it's just like people on top of each other a lot of days. So last year I thought I would like canoe across a local river that I duck hunt, because I would always hear turkeys while I duck hunt. And coincidentally, like there's yet another boat like crossing the river to like a turkey. So like, you gotta be kidding me. But luckily I at least got my friend a shot on a bird and he missed it. And then those guys got a bird. So, you know, even though we were next to each other, it wasn't such a big deal, but yeah, turkeys on the brain for sure.
What is it, like a mid-April season opening for you guys out there?
We are the whole month of May. So yeah, May 1 through 31. And you can hunt till noon every day. I don't know if it's like that everywhere, but yeah, noon hunting.
It's not here. I'm familiar with some of that. Listeners will know I've been dabbling in the turkey hunting, and I'm definitely excited this year. I've got a Wisconsin tag and Minnesota's over the counter. So very much looking forward to it. And the early spring kind of has everybody thinking that way, but we still got a ways to go before season opens. So Gabe, I wasn't sure you've been bit by the turkey bug a little bit, sounds like.
Oh yeah, big time. I love chasing turkeys. And I play offense with turkeys. Okay. I may not even take a decoy with me. I'm moving and grooving and chasing them and getting blown up. And I love chasing turkeys. I got burnt when I moved to Wisconsin, in Michigan, where that's the only spot I've turkey hunted. You know, there's the application period, and then that extends into the spring of the year that the actual season's going to be quite. And then I've always had an opportunity to buy over the counter tags. And when I moved to Wisconsin this last year, I was all fired up about it, right? I'm watching my turkey hunting videos, getting pumped for the season. And now I'm like, I should, you know, I got to look in the tag situation a little bit. And it's like the second week of December or something. And I was, you know, it was already in January or February when I was looking at it. So I was not pleasantly surprised with that information, and was not able to get a tag in Wisconsin last year, but just hopped over to the UP and got it done over there.
Okay. How does so Michigan is over the counter, like everywhere, basically?
I don't know specifically. We have different zones, this past, they've kind of expanded some of those. We are still, you know, a one bird state. But I have a lot of, you know, from growing up in Southeast Michigan, I have a lot of access to private land down here. Mm. And they have effectively a tag that you can hunt almost entirely the whole season, you know, on the southern half of the Lower Peninsula, on a private land tag. So been very fortunate, to kind of have that, some of that access that I do, and be able to have a larger window of a season.
Yeah. Got it. Yeah. Again, familiarizing myself with the different sort of systems, and Wisconsin's, their turkey system is older, I feel like, but I don't know if that's the right way to describe it. It's different than Minnesota. Minnesota, we're one bird, hunt anywhere, over the counter. They recently changed that, so it opens up a lot of opportunity, which is nice. But yeah, the Wisconsin one is zoned out and draw and it's not as easy to, and I'm a non-resident too, so it's harder to get tags in certain zones, not everywhere, but yeah, that's right around the corner. I'm excited.
And I'm not a very good turkey hunter by any means. I am the box call yelper. That's it. So I need to take advantage of the first couple days hard
get
and
there
the last
early.
Couple days hard. Yeah. Well educated turkey somewhere in the middle doesn't pan out for me very
well. Well, that sounds a lot like my, if you could call it success, but I bagged a few birds on my own now, and yeah, they're coming late in the season, so maybe, you know, it's the desperate gobbler, and I can barely, you know, barely make a sound on the call, but sound enough to yeah, make old Tom come running in.
That's all you mean.
What I have yet to have happen is to bag a bird that comes like all the way in. That's kind of like the next thing on my, like, I want him. I've interacted with him. I've called in my own, the last two birds on my own, but I really would like to be right on top of one. I was with a buddy at one time, yeah, and we had a Tom come screaming in, basically. So that was really cool, but I have yet to done it myself. But yeah, the thrill and the excitement of the calling and the bird interaction it's pretty unrivaled, especially for a springtime hunt. It's pretty cool.
It's a great opportunity to spend time with buddies in the woods too. I'm usually kind of a lone hunter when it comes to stuff, but one of my best friends in high school, you know, I think it was during COVID, he started getting pretty interested in turkey hunting, and we spent a ton of mornings together in turkey blind or chasing around all over the place. And this was right after he got his first bird dog, and it was right when I was on the list to get mine. And we go on trips out west twice a year, you know, spend God knows how many weekends together now, and it all, we you reflect back on that, you know, that turkey hunting, that ability to spend that time together kind of really rekindled our friendship. So it's a good opportunity for that as well.
Absolutely. Now we could spend all morning talking about turkey hunting probably, but we are here to talk about another favorite bird of ours, the American woodcock. I will attempt to segue. Kevin, did I read something that RGS-AWS has had partnered with, similar to the Pheasants Forever one, but not with NWTF? There was a, and they've done it before. I mean, the habitat organizations tend to coordinate and, you know, joint venture when applicable. But I thought I read something on that recently. Does that come to mind at all, or am I making it up?
So definitely on a project basis. I don't recall that we've signed any like sweeping agreement with them, but a lot of our partners, I mean, especially in my area in the Northeast, I think he's their biologist, Matt DeBona is his name, for NWTF, and he works with Todd Waldron on our Northeast team.
Okay.
And they've done a lot recently, like in Massachusetts, for instance. Especially a lot of states in the Northeast, you get a little bit of opposition to active forestry. And so if you can kind of get multiple conservation groups kind of like tag teaming projects, that's like a big win for everybody. I'm trying to remember if Minnesota or Wisconsin also did something with NWTF, but certainly Massachusetts comes to mind. And then actually we just got a guy on our team who previously was at NWTF. So Jeremy Collard in Minnesota, he just moved up to Ely. Certainly a turkey nut. Yeah, which is, when you meet, I don't know if you got to meet him at Pheasant Fest.
I did at Pheasant Fest. I got to call him this week.
Yeah, his family, I guess ancestors, if you want to call it that, were like Finnish immigrants that built a cabin up around Ely, but then his parents moved down to Florida. So he sounds like a good Southern boy and has just moved back to Ely to reclaim his Ely, Minnesota heritage. So,
wow, that's crazy.
No one could believe that he had anything to do with Minnesota when they would meet him. So he's working on the accent. But.
Oh, that's so cool.
Well, you'll like Jeremy a lot. He's a really good guy, Nick. I know. Yeah, Pheasant Fest, there's so many balls in there and moving and grooving. We tried to get over, but, you know, it didn't quite pan out. But also in our last bellwether, and that might be what you were referring to, Nick, there was an agreement, I think, for four or five different timber harvests in Virginia, I want to say, that we partnered with NWTF on down there.
Okay. Yeah. That's it's pr- probably likely I was looking at the bellwether, so that very well could be what was in my head. All right, let's. Okay. We're going to talk AWS as well, but since we're kind of talking about these memorandums of understandings and the like, Kevin, you want to tee us up on at Pheasant Fest? Saw you guys there, and I know Ben and Marilyn Vetter, CEOs of the organizations, got together and kind of made an announcement on a new sort of agreement moving forward. And there were lots of questions like, okay, we get it, but what does it mean, Kevin?
Yeah, sure. So we signed that at CWE. Both of our organizations were down there. And, you know, it's kind of like a handshake, you know, is a nice way to say it. It's an agreement that people might be familiar. Sometimes you see in like cop movies where like the FBI and the local police have an MOU where like, if we're on your turf, we tell you, and if they're on our turf, they tell us, and basically try to work together. So, you know, they're a significantly larger organization than ours, right? So there's a lot to be gained from their scale and resources and experience. And at the same time, we're kind of like the forestry professionals. So not just PF and QF, but, you know, we've done collaborations and agreements with Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation and Moose Collaborative up in, I think, northern Minnesota, and NWTF and Ducks Unlimited and, you know, multiple groups that, you know, when it comes to forests, you know, we are the ones with sort of the claim to fame on getting things done. So what you see in the Southeast is a lot of crossover habitat between quail and woodcock, especially. And so that's probably where you're going to see the most activity. But, you know, even like up in Minnesota, for instance, you might find some crossover projects where the prairie meets the timber, you know, perhaps. But for now, I think the focus is probably going to be in the Southeast.
Yeah. Well, that's definitely on top of mind for me as I just made my first trip down there. And as I think I share, I drove down there, which sounds silly, but I enjoyed it. Like, I had perfect driving weather and I got to see the Southeast, a region of the country that I'd never really been through and spent time through. And man, it was really interesting to see the pines, the Georgia pine, the piney woods, and see that underbrush. And in areas where there was like what looked to me like good habitat. I mean, first of all, it reminded me a lot of like the sand barren country that I see up here with red pine and hazel brush and scrub oak. So it like, it almost like if I blinked and like woke up, I would think I was maybe in Wisconsin. So that was intriguing. But then the quail woodcock overlap, I mean, I've heard of that and I've talked to many people that do those sorts of mixed bag hunts. And I did do a quick sort of release bird Johnny House quail walk through some cover, and the folks I was with said, you know, not right now, we're not seeing them, but on any other given day, basically you wouldn't know if you were on the swamp edge if you're going to flush a released quail or a woodcock. So very very fresh in my mind seeing that kind of habitat and seeing how that agreement makes a lot of sense in that area, just with that habitat overlap. That's really cool.
Yeah. And one of the things that certainly the telemetry tracking of woodcock has taught us in recent years is just that I believe it's one in every three migrating woodcocks is passing through that Piedmont coastal plains region. So it just makes absolute sense. Like right now, our region that we have is the Southern Appalachian region. So like typically mountainous. And that's because it's both grouse and woodcock oriented. But currently we're actually hiring right now a forest conservation director, which is like the cornerstone conservation position of our regions for the Piedmont Coastal Plains. So that's basically our sixth region that we're looking to add. And that person is going to build a team that's focused on how can we do everything east of the Appalachians to the coast. And I don't know if their territory will cover like south and in the Mississippi Delta, like Louisiana, whatnot, or if that'll be more southern apps, but significant push to add resources to woodcock migration on the eastern slopes.
Yeah, awesome.
And it's a perfect time kind of for that achievement because it's the 10-year anniversary this year of AWS. So 2024 is the year of the Timberdoodle.
Gearing up for your next hunt? Check out Ugly Dog Hunting Company for all your dog supply needs. Ugly Dog Hunting carries a full line of products for your bird dog and even some for you. Whether you're looking for dog collars, GPS tracking devices, kennels, beds, leads, training equipment, or first aid supplies, Ugly Dog Hunting carries it and a whole lot more. New owner of the company and friend of the Birdshot podcast, Mike Nadusky, loves to remind me that while I do hunt with pretty dogs, every dog can be an ugly dog. Check out the entire selection of gear for you and your bird dog at uglydoghunting.com. For many upland hunters, along with their passion for dogs, birds, and the places we chase them, comes a passion for shotguns. Upland Gun Company specializes in customizing shotguns for the upland bird hunter, imported from Italy and shipped direct to an FFL near you. Select from one of their side-by-side or over-under shotgun platforms and customize the fit, function, and aesthetics to your liking. Design and build your next upland hunting shotgun with Upland Gun Company today. Visit uplandguncompany.com.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, The Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, as exhibited by Gabe's wonderful hat there from Duck Camp.
Yeah, yeah. I was hoping you guys were gonna wear those. I got the again audio only. We'll see, but the Covers magazine featuring some wonderful woodcock art by our good friend Jay Dowd, and right there in bold print, celebrating 10 years of the American Woodcock Society. So yeah, that goes back to when I was with RGS officially. As a staff member, that was 2015 through 17. And so that was in the infancy. And now here we are 10 years later with the creation of American Woodcock Society. And it's a big push for you guys right now. So thanks for doing my job, Gabe, and bringing that up. And tell us a little bit about the membership drive that you guys have going and some of the things. I know tomorrow this will come out after, but I imagine, will the Pike thing be available for folks to go check out? Probably. In on a replay?
Yeah, certainly. So we are going to do a Pike Live Birds and Brew tomorrow at Wednesday, March 13th, where we're going to have a bunch of conservation staff from around the region and a few of the other engagement and development oriented folks. And basically, we want it to be a casual chat. I mean, kind of like what we're having here, where people who may read every newsletter or not read every newsletter can hear what's going on. Live Q&A, certainly a part of it, so that we can try and ask questions that, you know, we might not hear, you know, like we always love it when we're sort of educated on what questions we might not be answering for our audience. But the drive runs until the 15th, but for podcast listeners of Birdshot, if you give us the code Birdshot24 by the end of March on the uplandstore.org, we're going to give you that special promo for the membership drive. So depending on what level you sign up for, we have the Duck Camp Woodcock hat at every level that Gabe is wearing. If you're looking at this on video, at the conservation member and above, that includes the Jay Dowd and Pike t-shirt, which has that awesome artwork that's also on the cover of Covers Magazine. Every subscription level gets you a subscription to Covers Magazine, which is our quarterly magazine. And we also have a Browning folding knife for the AWS 10-year anniversary that you can add on to your purchases as well. And then from there, I don't want to go full tilt into it, but we've also got a wax cotton shell bag. That's something we've never done before, so that's pretty awesome. And also an Orvis vest for it has an AWS 10-year logo on it as well. So your membership matters because it gives us a body of people who are a constituency that cares. So when we go to legislators, when we sometimes fill out grants, they want to know how many members we have, basically to tell if we're able to substantiate our ability to execute on projects. And I'll, you know, preempt a question that kind of comes up a lot in media is, you know, I think Nick Adair has posed this, not specifically about us, but just in general, like conservation groups every year seem to be raising more members, raising more money. So how does that correlate to getting more birds? And the best way that I think we can answer it is that's table stakes for us, is it lets us play bigger games than we've been able to play before. As an example, in the fall, we signed the largest conservation agreement that we've ever done before with the U.S. Forestry Service for Region 9. And so that's like Minnesota or Wisconsin over to Vermont or New Hampshire, and then down, I don't know if it's Pennsylvania, it cuts off, but basically the whole northeastern quadrant of the United States. And we weren't able to do that until we had a track record of escalating and delivering on larger projects. But to participate in that, we have to outlay a huge amount of money, like the largest amount of money we probably ever laid out for a single thing. So, I mean, that's basically where that money goes, is our ability to execute on bigger projects. So, look at our blog. I mean, you can see we've leveled up every year since 2020, when kind of our model changed. And, you know, it's really no signs of stopping. We just hope that people put the faith in us to join. And, you know, and whether you see it now or you see it in 5 years or whether you see it in 10 years, investments are being made for the future of the birds. So, you know, that's what we would love to have you partner with us on.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, it's... I definitely appreciate the inside intel. And I mean, from at least from my perspective, the shift to habitat delivery and the stewardship agreements, those are all pretty intriguing to me. And I don't know that those kinds of agreements were in place prior, but that those have the unique sort of dynamic where you do the work and the timber sale proceeds stay in that area to continue to do the habitat work on those national forests where the agreements are made. And I just, in one of the recent, I think it was the winter issue, there was a big synopsis of, I think maybe what you were talking about, Kevin, where it was a lot of different stewardship agreements on different national forests. So always great to see that. And I don't know where you guys are at for membership now, but I guess I have a unique perspective in that I've been a member, a volunteer, a staff member, all sorts of things with RGS. So like I have a fairly intimate knowledge of the organization, and I know, you know, the size of the organization. It's not a huge group relative to how many grouse and woodcock mm-hmm. hunters there are or other upland bird hunting groups. So, to see you guys kind of fighting above your weight class and get stuff done, it's cool to see. And I hope it continues.
Yeah, I appreciate that very much.
Snowball's starting to really get bigger.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. What
in Wisconsin role... we have, you know.
Oh, go ahead.
Nope, you're good.
I got a little bit of a delay here, so apologies for that, guys. But what role has the woodcock played in your love affair with upland bird hunting and bird dogs?
The pretty significant one, I would say. Darting off this whole deal of getting a bird dog and chasing after rough grouse, et cetera, and getting burnt enough times and not necessarily being able to connect with them and coming across some woodcock along the way has been really a wonderful thing for me and my kind of learning process since I started getting involved, as well as the development for the dog. I think, you know, they hold a very, very special place in my heart. I am certainly more of a grouse hunter than a woodcock hunter, I would say. But specifically, I just moved back to Southeast Michigan, and we don't have a ton of grouse down here by any means. I think there's going to be an opportunity this coming year, and depending how long I'm living in this segment of the state, to kind of further develop my relationship with the timber doodle, because some of the after work, et cetera, before, committing to a larger trip or excursion and throughout the season, I think I'm going to spend a little bit more time focusing on them and developing, I guess you could say, our relationship outside of the hunting season.
Yeah. And I was curious about that. You have your first 2-3 bird dogs now. And I know, in my experience, the woodcock plays a pretty significant role, I think, for a lot of folks in some of those early formative pointing dog adventures. And I mean, they're kind of a light bulb for I think both the hunter and the bird dog at times. And as you pointed out, for a lot of people, woodcock is one of the wild game birds that, because of their migration, a lot of people end up having access to at various points in the year. So they are somewhat of a gateway drug, if you will. And they were for me. I would definitely say that.
When I didn't have my dogs, the first year I really kind of went a go at this, I, by the grace of God, was able to, not knowing anything about it, was able to harvest a rough grouse in the UP. And then I stumbled upon a woodcock, and I connected with it, and that, I don't think there will be another. I thought I was the man to get a, I called my dad. Hey, man, I shot a woodcock. I can't believe it. These things are, I thought they're rare. And it's just funny to go kind of full circle on that. But yeah, that very first one, I think, holds more significance. And that was the first time I've really ever had seen one in person. I hadn't seen them sky dancing or any of that stuff ahead of that first flush and connecting with it without a dog too. Still to this day, I have no idea how I got it to it to fly, but that is the special woodcock for me.
Kevin, do you have something to throw in?
I think I shot my first one actually while I was hunting the stock pheasants in the local forest. And I remember it was kind of like, all bets are off on these pheasants. I mean, it's just like, wow, this woodcock is amazing. And I even have a picture of it my friend took where I've got this thing and I'm like, what the hell is this? And it was just the freaking coolest thing. But I love, where you're talking about the light switch turning on. A few years ago, I was running woodcock in the spring, and this same little strip of cover that I walked by a million times the whole rest of the year, for that one day was when the migration was there, and it was the most fun, amazing place, in the world. So it's I think we had 12 points in an hour or something like that, and just a little hedgerow across a road. And the next day it went back to being, boring old hedgerow, nothing special about it. So it's woodcock came in and turned the magic on for that little moment. And, have a lifetime memory with a dog, and then the next day they're gone, and might not ever find them there again. I might get the day wrong, but I think that's amazing just how they, and when you get into the popcorn where there's they're popping all over the place, I mean, that's pretty fun too. But yeah, I think you nailed it when you said that they kind of give everyone an ability to experience a wild bird, and not just obviously the places tons of wild birds, but people who might not otherwise find them.
Right.
I remember the first pheasant fest I went to, it was in Omaha a couple of years ago. And one of the guys said, oh yeah, I was pheasant hunting and we put up a woodcock. And I said, you didn't hit it, did you? And he's like, no, I didn't. And I said, I'll imagine doing that. And that's what you want is those things all the time. They're, sometimes easy and sometimes not to hit. So he appreciated it.
Yeah, they are a bit, and it's what adds to the appeal and the allure. They're a mysterious bird. And I was curious, Gabe, because I used to do a lot of grouse hunting dogless and flushed I don't really remember ever flushing woodcock. And I know why, because I just was not, we were walking trails and doing the things that I felt I needed to do to give myself a chance to shoot a grouse. And I just was not busting the brush and down in the alders and everything looking for woodcock. But then you get that, you get that bird dog and all of a sudden you're like, eyes are open to like, oh my, these birds are everywhere, you know? And I remember the first time I ever shot a woodcock was one of my, I would think I was in high school, was with a buddy of mine and they had an English setter. So it was also like probably the first time I ever hunted over a pointing dog. And we saw some grouse that day. I know my buddy and my buddy's dad and me missed an unbelievable opportunity on a grouse that flushed right off. And so we both like just looked at each other and laughed. And like, I didn't really know at the time because that was my first sort of experience shooting at grouse over a dog. But his dad, I could tell in hindsight, he was like, yeah, I just missed golden opportunity there over the dog. But then the dog also pointed some woodcock and I think I shot two that day. I was shooting my old Browning 12 gauge pump, which I thought was just the coolest gun in the world at the time. And, and I remember my buddy's dad, like I killed two woodcock. He's like, whoa, what gun are you shooting? And I told him, and he's like, well, you can really shoot it. And I remember that made me feel pretty proud that day. So just again, those times, first woodcock, first pointing dog stuff. And that, I mean, that has obviously stuck with me. So I know that's similar for a lot of folks.
I actually, once I got Josie, who's my first bird dog, I almost, not for a point of contention, but I kind of tried to stay away from woodcock, the beginning of her development, our first season. Not that I don't have a fascination for them. I absolutely love to eat them. They're great birds, but I was really focused on, I want this dog to be a grouse dog. So that first season, I tried to kind of stay clear of them a little bit. And ever since, I did the same thing with Lila, my second, kind of her first season. And then after that, we have a whole lot of fun when they come in.
Yeah. That is interesting because I know where your dogs come from. Kyle Warren, Paint River Llewellyns, and he has, we talked about that. He mentioned it on the show, I think, when I interviewed him last fall about sort of his, oftentimes woodcock get thrown up as this great first bird for young pointing dogs. And I certainly bought into that at one time. And it's almost more for the, you can see it's like for the hunter, he gets a lot of activity and action. And I think I would say that my opinion has change. I don't know that I have a strong opinion on it, but almost like not intentionally, I worked my second dog on more grouse than I didn't go out looking for woodcock. That's the best way I would put it. You're still going to encounter them, but it's sort of like I prioritize finding grouse first. And it is interesting how that plays out in the development of the dogs. And I've still got a small sample size, obviously, but not to get into the whole dog training and that side of things. But it's interesting to point out because it is a common thing for folks to suggest that, best thing you can do for a young dog is go put them on a bunch of woodcock. And I guess there's varying opinions on that.
Sorry to open up a box of worms on that.
Yeah. Well, we can all still be advocates and ambassadors for the woodcock and AWS. And I think I wanted to mention, Kevin, you were kind of pointing out, like there's a great article right at the beginning of the Covers magazine by Edward Nickens. And he goes into, again, I feel like he sort of captures the sentiment surrounding woodcock and the sort of mysterious little bird, and they come and they go and they're gone under cover of night. And one day you're covered up with them and the sky dance. I mean, all of the elements about woodcock and the fact that they share habitat oftentimes with grouse, quail, other game birds. I mean, they're just, it's a hard bird not to love. And there is, man, you guys have been around this long enough. Like people have different opinions of woodcock. And sometimes I laugh. I've encountered, it's almost like a disdain for them. And I never really understood that, but I can maybe understand where it comes from, more of a bird dog hunting type thing. But I appreciate the bird and they're a unique little creature.
Yeah, agreed. Absolutely.
Right there with you.
I also withhold all my disdain for, I just like put it into the porcupine. That's the only.
You budgeted it all for the porcupine.
Why can't we focus on the common enemy, the porcupine?
What kind of dog do you have, Kevin?
I have a Vizsla, a male Vizsla. Okay. And I'm on the list to get a German wire here this summer. So
that's where the porcupine is staying.
I thought you said you don't like
porcupines. If I have problems with porcupine, yeah, I know. Yeah,
He's about to punish him a lot.
Yeah, out of the frying pan. I got my training wheels on porcupines. They're about to come off.
I guess the porcupine disdain takes various forms, and in Kevin's, it's all out. When's a projection for the GWP?
I think June, July. As long as it's pending enough males in the litters. So yeah, I'm excited though. I'm like ready for another dog. You know, and again, mainly because of the duck hunting, that's why I was like looking to make the switch. Like my dog's a great upland dog, but he's definitely jumped in some icy water and not wanting to go back in there. I think the wire hair shouldn't have an issue with that.
Gabe, you had something.
I think I might have lost it. Oh, no, I was going to say, have you had, I know we both have setters, Hartley or Rose, have they experienced much porcupine?
I've been really lucky in that. Yeah, I've been really lucky in that regard. Hartley has never paid any attention to a porcupine. Rose has found a couple. At one point, I remember she was, and I think I told the story before, she was on point, and I walked in thinking I'm going to flush a grouse, and all of a sudden, I see this like little basketball size. It was a small porcupine, but I mean, she was like, I mean, couldn't have been more than 12 inches from this thing. And I just remember thinking to myself, well, if it's going to happen, this is it. Because you could, you know, when a bird dog's on point, the tent, you could just feel the tension in the air. And I just slowly got up to her and I think got a finger around her collar. And she never did lunge or anything, but we got them separated. And yeah, I've been lucky. My dogs don't really pay any attention to them. And I hope it stays that way. Do you guys have a favorite woodcock recipe?
I usually put mine in gumbo, actually. Like a couple of years in a row, I like made gumbo around Christmas, and we'll put in woodcock, squirrel, sausage, duck, you know, just kind of random stuff. So, especially if we have friends over and I want them to like try a bunch of different things, you know, but have it not be like completely off the radar for them. You know, I've done that.
Gabe?
You were talking about that quite a lot at Pheasant Fest, Kevin, and I love to cook, and I've never done any type of gumbo or anything like that. So I think I'm going to do that this fall.
I had gumbo for the first time, I don't know, 5 years ago, maybe something like that. Four or 5 years ago, a friend of ours she grew up in Alabama, but made gumbo, and I just said, this is like the best food I've ever eaten in my life. So, I turned 40 last year. We actually road tripped to Louisiana because I wanted to eat gumbo in Louisiana. I get to, it was that good. And I love all the Cajun food. I've become like a big fan of the way they do life down there.
I like to keep it really simple with woodcock. Breast-wise, I have kind of a strong opinion. I hear frequently, oh, you can't eat those, or they're not good, or this or that. I have a very strong opinion that they should not be cooked any more than medium rare. And I probably lean more on the rare side of things, but salt, pepper, olive oil, or butter in a really hot skillet, 10-15 seconds each side. And then generally I use them as kind of more of an appetizer or hors d'oeuvre. Into the breast, I'll do really slim, thin slices. You know, capers, a little cream cheese, this, that, something on a cracker. One of my favorite ways to do their breasts. And I would just say to everybody, make sure you save your woodcock legs. I hear all the time that people do not save the leg of the woodcock, and they're tremendous. They fly so much. They have, obviously very, very dark, dark breast, but their leg and their thigh is all white meat. And there's, you know, from their little tiny woodcock stature, there's effectively their one bone up their leg all the way into their hip joint. And if you take that off, you can make just the most delicious little medallions. Again, salt, pepper, maybe a little bit of flour, you know, celery salt, whatever you want. But they're tremendous little appetizer that are just like little woodcock leg suckers almost. They're excellent. So keep your legs, your woodcock hunter.
Oh, I love that. I love, Gabe, you sound like you got a little bit of chef going on there. I like it.
Man, I love to cook. I absolutely love to cook. There's two things I like to do, hunt and cook. Then obviously eat.
Yeah, for sure. I do not consider myself a chef at all, but as you pointed out, a lot of times with game birds, you can do it simply. Salt, pepper, I'll use butter and onions, you know, for grouse, and I'll strip those out. And same with wood. I mean, I love woodcock, and to your, you know, you definitely don't want to overcook them. And I think, like with lots of wild game, if people say they don't like it, there's a pretty decent chance they had some overcooked wild game. So if you're mindful of that, it doesn't take a whole lot of seasoning or flavor. But dude, the capers and cracker and cream, you kind of got me. I think I got a few woodcock left in the freezer. I might need to bust those out. I'm getting hungry.
That's good. And then woodcock fat too. Same if you shoot a really fatty little woodcock, all that fat, you know, I try to pluck most of my breasts but even if you don't do that and you see some fat in there, save it. Woodcock fat is tremendous as well.
Did you see earlier
in the season?
So I cook it with, like, if I pluck the woodcock breast, right, and then cut each of them out, I will save, you know, the skin on the front facing portion, and then usually the fat with that. But I will fry it. I'll reduce it down in a pan if I'm, you know, cooking their breasts or the legs, etc. It's like, if you can get it, sometimes they almost have a fat little cap on them. Just more flavor, absolutely delicious. But I'm not sitting there reduced, you know.
Yeah. I was like, how many woodcock
for the year?
It is nice when you bag one and you see those little fat strips on the side of the breast. That's, you know, you're getting some extra flavor there for sure. Kevin,
did you guys see Hank Shaw had a picture this fall where he had rendered down woodcock fat, and he had a glass shotgun shell shot glass. And it, like, just filled up the shotgun shell glass. It's like such a cool tick. Like, yeah, pure gold looking woodcock fat that he had melted down. It was great.
Awesome. Well, gents, we're about ready to wrap up. When do you get your dogs back, Gabe? You gonna be out before the quiet seasons began, chasing birds a little bit?
Oh, absolutely. I was actually just texting Kyle this morning. They've both been bred. And ready to return. So I'm probably going to head up there at some point this weekend, grab them. We have, you know, 2 months or so until puppies come. They're bred. I think their due dates are about 5 days apart. So I'll have them for a little bit down here. Hopefully try to connect on some of these little timber doodlers while they're back. And then they head back up to the UP midsummer, I think, or no. We'll be up there kind of the third weekend of April and have a whole bunch of puppies. That guy's going to have his hands full. And then so am I, because I've decided I am going to keep I'm going to keep a puppy out of Lila, who's my second dogs. I'm going to keep a pup out of that litter. So no time like the present. I'm single. I'm young. I got a lot of gas in the tank. I'm like, now's the time to have three. They're like, what? You're getting another dog? I said, absolutely.
Good for you, man. I was gonna ask. You got both dogs, puppies on the way. I was wondering if you were gonna keep one or two. It sounds like at least one for now.
Listen, two would be a bit of a handful. I'm gonna keep a Lila puppy, and mentioned Bailey earlier. She actually got bred to Riffle.
Oh yeah, so that's right.
I'll be excited for that.
All right, guys. Well, what, anything else as far as, I don't know, anything on the horizon? Kevin, you're kind of in the loop on everything. Any other sort of, I guess one question I forgot to ask was, with it being the 10-year anniversary of AWS, you know, to me, one of the things that stands out is the Eastern Woodcock Migration Project with Eric Blumberg. I interviewed him years ago, and I might try to get him on again because he's got a piece in the latest mag. And, you know, RGS, AWS they were critical in the early stages of that in helping to fund the beginning. And as Eric was kind of laying out, like, then the success of the project now, it kind of has its own momentum moving forward. Obviously, AWS is still an amplifier for that work. But any other things of note as far as like 10 years of AWS? Like, what's the rap sheet? Any other major accomplishments?
Yeah, so perfect thing to bring up. What we've got on the horizon is one, we have a user-generated Woodcock migration map on the site that doesn't always get the light of day, but that's going to be amplified probably like end of this week or next, just so that way if people are finding Woodcock in their local woods, they can put a point on the map. And once it gets approved, it shows up as like a little marker. Including notes, like if you say it was two males or two females or, you know, whatever the situation was. So we're happy to support people in, documenting where the woodcock are in their own locales. And that also, which is funny, I didn't learn this until recently. It actually has a timeline slider on it. So you could actually dial it back to like what was going on last March or whatever. So you could basically cue that into, what the current migration is. And we want to do a better job of kind of highlighting the relationship with the Eastern Woodcock Migration Cooperative. So, again, we still fund and support it. And we get almost weekly or more reports from the team over there, from University of Maine and Eric and his folks. And the thing that we want to make sure is like digestible for the average person is just we get a lot of data from them, and so we want to make sure that it's like data that they can look at quickly and easily and say, oh cool, that's what's going on with woodcock. So they do such a wonderful job in presenting that science that we've been trying to brainstorm how to make that like a really great way to honor what they do. So more on woodcock basically. And just in terms of habitat, again, like that Piedmont expansion is going to be a pretty big deal. And so I don't know if we saw in the fall, but just this came to mind, Leinenkugel Brewery. So we actually are doing a woodcock habitat project on their brewery campus. So that's something in the Chippewa Falls area that once it breaks ground, I'm sure we'll have some coverage on it. But very cool corporate model to consider a habitat project along a creek that benefits woodcock.
Awesome. You guys know what cedar waxwings are?
They are my favorite non-game bird.
Really?
You have a bunch of them hanging out?
Yes. I've gotten to know them. I've got mountain ash trees outside of my property, and I don't know if you guys can see the shadows flickering off my face. I'm looking out the window here, but yeah, they come in hordes. There's like 100 of them in there. They come and they hammer the mountain ash berries, and my two young boys love watching them, and I didn't really know a whole lot about them before we started seeing the flocks of them in our yards. I feel like the last couple of years we've seen more because we've lived here for a while. Okay. But why do you love them, Gabe?
They're just a really, really cool bird to me. Growing up camping, XYZ, spent a lot of time in the UP as a young kid. They were like this bird that was up there that we didn't see very much down here. And just they held a really special spot in my heart. And sometimes when I'm out fishing, they kind of, as like you said, can come in hordes on a stream or, kind of at dusk or whatnot. You're sitting there and all of a sudden here comes one, here comes another one. And then there's 30, 40 of them in there, and cedar trees and those areas just also kind of hold a special place in my heart. So cool. Little
you're
birds.
Speaking my language, man. The symbolic nature of certain birds and places and habitats and the great North Woods. And that's the kind of stuff that gets me fired up. So yeah, but the cedar waxwings, they make a very distinct sound and they've got a little like a yellow tip on their tail. I mean, they are a neat bird. So I'm not arguing with you. What else will you leave us with, Gabe? What's coming up in your region? I know you kind of you recently sort of switched roles at RGS, moved locations, and I know you hit the ground running. But what's coming up for folks in that part of the world?
A lot of different stuff. So yeah, I was in Wisconsin in the Western Upper Peninsula of Michigan. We are in the final stages of getting that position filled. So we're really excited about that. Going to be welcoming a new team member to the organization and specifically that region. I am now in the Eastern Upper Peninsula of Michigan,
Lower Peninsula, Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois. We got a lot of great stuff going. I'm still trying to kind of get my feet under me and meet all of these chapters in this Eastern Great Lakes region. Already hosted quite a handful of events, but couple different things that's coming up for people, especially if they, you know, are a grouse and woodcock hunter, or maybe if they're not and they want to get involved or you know, learn some of the tricks of the trades. This year we have quite a few different you know, hunt based events that's going on. Obviously the Wisconsin Grouse Camp, that's kind of our R3 event. It's a long weekend in September. Presentations, demonstrations, and two different days of mentored hunting. So that's a great event for anybody that's interested of trying to figure out this whole grouse and woodcock thing. This year in Michigan, we're going to be hosting the first annual Michigan grouse and woodcock hunt in the northern lower. Still need to get quite a few of those things ironed out, but that's going to be kind of in the latter part of October, third week of October. We have the New York grouse and woodcock hunt for folks that live out there on Kevin's neck of the woods. I want to make sure I don't miss anything from these regions. And then the grand and glorious upland bird hunt in Pennsylvania. That event's been going on for quite a while and is really well regarded. And this year as well, kind of as the kickoff on the 10-year AWS, we're looking at trying to incorporate a Southern Appalachian woodcock hunt. Whether that's going to be the end of 2024 or the beginning of 2025 is kind of TBD to get that ironed out. But excited to be having all these different kind of hunting-based events this fall and being able to get people involved that way as well.
Now you got me thinking about fall hunting seasons, Gabe.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's bad.
Can you see the birds flying by my window? Well, now what? They're gone, but...
No, when you were standing there, I could see all the different shadows bouncing. And you weren't kidding.
I love it. Kevin, any other final thoughts from you? Otherwise, membership drive will be available for folks. Birdshot 24. I don't know if you have a dedicated landing page or anything, but again, we can circle up as needed after this show, but folks can take advantage of that.
Yeah, I think we'll try to get you a special landing page so they can see what exactly they're going to get out of the drive promo. And thank you for having us on, and appreciate everybody for letting us talk about what we're up to. And certainly anybody who's already signed up for membership, we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you guys, and the birds are benefiting from it. So appreciate it.
And if somebody just wants
to get that
cool duck camp hat too, I'm sure they could gift a membership or do something like that. I think I don't know if I'm as hip as Gabe to be wearing the duck camp hat, but I really do like it. The guys Parker and the guys from the Upland Gun Company booth at Pheasant Fest, they went over and got hats, and I was kind of jealous. So I might have to, the Birdshot podcast might have to gift a membership or two just so I can get one of those hats.
Nick, on that point, I will let you know, this is the very first this style of hat I have ever had and was almost against it. But I'll tell you what, I think I'm pulling it off. And if I can, I've seen you rock a flat bill Upland Gun Company.
I'm kind of wearing one right now. So yeah,
you can pull it.
You got one right now.
Yeah. No, you're killing it, brother. So yeah, good on you. And I'm going to follow in line. All right, guys, hang with me for just a second. That does it for this episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Thanks for tuning in, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and share. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.
Hey everyone, this is Nick from the Gun Dog It Yourself podcast. If you enjoyed this show, then you might want to check out my show as well. We highlight and break down the ins and outs of training your own hunting dog. Whether it's a bird dog or even the occasional hound dog episode, we cover all topics related to hunting dogs. Check out Gundoggy Yourself on any podcast streaming platform and hit the subscribe button to be sure not to miss any future episodes.